It is Monday, February 17th. It is President's Day. It's LA Podcast. I'm Scott Fraser here with Hayes Davenport and Alyssa Walker. Good morning, guys.
We'll be celebrating our LA presidents today. Uh-huh. Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan are the two the entire episode. We will be celebrating the presidents that spent time in Los Angeles.
Live from the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley.
Almost engulfed in flames.
That sounded like you were doing, by the way, the movie Independence Day, where it's like, we will celebrate our President's Day. Action movie narration.
First of all, I want to say we did some endorsements last week for some of the more competitive races in the city and county. We got a lot of questions, people asking if we were going to write up a voter guide. Yes, we are going to do that. It is going to come out this week. So sorry if you voted already, but we will be releasing our voter guide in print very soon, and we'll be announcing it on all our social media, including our Twitter at the LA Pod.
LA Stories.
I do want to tip that we have a guest this week, Aaron Mendelson from KPCC/LAist will be joining us to talk about his enormous, horrifying, the story about PAMA management, a slumlord with a very long history of code violations that has gotten away with it through political influence. He will be coming on the show to talk about that in the second half. First, LA Stories. Go ahead.
Okay, I have a story. It's more just a movement to join.
Let's hear it.
Did you get your real IDs yet?
I have not. I've been putting it off.
Okay, good news. I don't think we should get them.
Oh,
and I'm not getting them
specifically.
Well, if you believe in freedom, Hayes.
you're a sovereign citizen. Is that right, Alyssa?
I am. I think this.
What's your YouTube channel again?
It's a Agenda 21. So I kept seeing these stories. You've probably seen them too. It's like, if you don't get real ID, you will die. You know, it's just it's like this gloom and doom. And the deadline is coming up in October this year where you have to have a real ID. And if you don't have one, you can't board a plane, a domestic flight. So I kept seeing all these stories, and Steve Lopez had a column about like what a pain it is to go to the DMV, which that's not really news, and how unprepared.
Dave Perry has written that column.
Yeah. How the DMV is just not really prepared from all these people. Anyway, and I was really looking at all these stories and very naively asked, you know, out loud, like, why aren't they just saying get a passport, or if you have a passport, you can use it? Because there's no real reason why you should rush to get this if you have a valid passport, or if you use it to travel, which I do because my kids have passports and that's just what I carry, my satchel of passports when we go places. And I read this amazing story by Joe Matthews at Zocalo, and he's saying resist. Uh-huh. Do not get one. Because the history of real ID, once I did some digging, you know, I don't know if you remember after 9/11, one or more of the terrorists had maybe a driver's license, but not a visa, right? Yeah. So this whole loophole that you could be a criminal who could have a driver's license and you can fly around the country. They wanted to make sure that was closed. So it kind of was proposed, but then states didn't really follow through with it. It was just kind of like this idea, like we have this, you know, thing, but you know, nobody was really enforcing it. And then our new administration put this urgency to enforce it and put this date on it. And now you can probably understand where I'm going with this, because the goal of Real ID is to create two different types of citizens.
Yeah.
With one, if you have your papers readily available,
you can internally move around the country.
Yes. And I can't believe there hasn't been more. Joe's essay on Zocalo is so good because it really outlines, like, why would you sign up for something that your neighbor might not be able to get? And why should you be able to fly around and leave the country, have a passport? And then someone who just wants to go to like Phoenix to see their family can no longer get on a plane? Yeah. Like, what are we trying to do here? And he spells out this very dystopian future where next year, next election, whatever they say, actually, you have to have a real ID to vote. Or actually, you have to have a real ID to apply for a job. And so it becomes this authoritarian regime, you know, like many others that we've seen before. So I'm not going to get one. And if you want to avoid the DMV, you can just not go. As long as you have a passport, if you want to fly, but maybe we should fly less too. Right. So I'm just going to throw that in there. But anyway, I just can't believe there's more people that are just like not really looking at the danger of what this is presenting here.
I was totally unaware or it didn't even like question. I mean, it's like it's disguised by just like bureaucratic boringness, yeah, where you're just like, okay, some more bullshit that we have to do. But yeah, of course, there's something disgusting behind it.
Is you have a story?
Not really. I mean, I think we can just tell yours and then we can get into it.
Well,
I'll see if I have one while you're talking.
I think my actual story that's related to the city of LA is about going to Echo Park Lake again, following up on some previous stories that we've told. The actual most noteworthy thing that happened to me this week has nothing to do with LA, and it's that I accidentally went on antidepressant withdrawal, and that made my week fucking hell for several days, because I'm a senile old millennial now, and I took the wrong medication for about 2 weeks.
Oh, no. So
it was hard and horrible, but it's getting better. But the actual LA story that I have is, so on Wednesday, following up on the weekly sweeps that are taking place at Echo Park Lake, sort of being organized by the city council, by the park rangers, the Department of Parks and Rec, who we'll talk more about later in this episode, they were met by to their surprise, by a group of about, I would say, like 60 to 80 activists, along with the people who actually are currently living there. This was a planned day of protest. We knew that the city was coming out to conduct sweeps and try and force, as they've said, residents out of the lake area. And Street Watch and CAN and Ground Game LA did a very good job turning people out to resist this action by the city. And once again, I would say for now, maybe like the fourth or fifth time in a row, the city has been forced to stand down after coordinating these. I think in this case, it was probably the most police that I've seen present, most law enforcement and city officials that I've seen be actually present for one of these sweeps to take place. And once again, they're ending up, instead of actually making people move all of their things and seizing belongings, they end up going through with their little grabbers, grabbing a couple pieces of trash, and then like literally, and that's it. And then they leave. And
light touch.
It's remarkable. The presence of the housed neighbors from the community, the presence of like even a, in this case, it was a rather sizable contingent from local media. It really changes the way that they interact with people in a dramatic way. And so just by virtue of people paying attention and showing up and not allowing this to go forward, it's been remarkably effective. And it's giving me a lot of hope. The thing that is most striking to me is I talked to a lot of people who were out there who said that they had never been to an action like that before, which is just amazing. It's really great that people are showing up and are taking seriously the mistreatment of our unhoused neighbors by the city. And hopefully we can force them to stop that permanently.
Once again, it's hard to escape when you're there, just how much money is being spent for like a few sanitation workers to grab, like, you know, like there was a little like breakfast tray out that people were eating from, and the sanitation workers, like three of them came through and just emptied the trash that was right next to the breakfast thing. And it was like, thanks, we could have done this. Like, sure. We were actually planning to. They sent the helicopter over again. So many huge dump trucks that showed up and then just left without anything being put in them. Also, Albert Corrado, friend of the show, was there. He's been a guest on the show before, and he said that he spoke to a sanitation employee afterwards who talked about how the people living there are addicts, mentally ill people, pedophiles. He said the young kids that are homeless, it's not about anything other than partying to them. Some of these people just need discipline. I'm not saying I'm the one to give it to them, but someone should.
Wow.
And so whatever city training programs they're doing for the people that the sanitation who are kind of on the front lines of homelessness in a lot of cases, it might not necessarily be sinking in with everybody.
Yeah, I like, just lastly, I would say I had one interaction with a police officer who is frequently on site leading these sweeps at Echo Park Lake. He was very offended by my use of the word sweep. So sweep, sweep, sweep.
This I'll say again.
When you've got trash grabbers, that does look like sweeping.
It's hard to know what they were intending for this one. But again, I will say, if it plays out exactly like this, where they throw out people's trash, mm-hmm. that I am willing to call that a cleanup.
Sure.
If that's what it takes, that is fine. But compare that to, so like we were talking about, the care programs that were more outreach and sanitation focused have been changed to be more about throwing away people's possessions and arresting people. And a lot of power has been given to each individual city council office. And one way that's manifested is in John Lee's office up in Chatsworth, Council District 12. Earlier this week, they had 5 sweeps in 3 days at one location.
Wow.
And which was in which his office, he's the one Republican, or I guess now no party preference or whatever. They're very open about like, yes, we ordered these. We get a lot of complaints about this. We want them to go away. They pack up their stuff and come back. And when they do, we will sweep them again until they stop coming back.
It totally just reflects the personality of the council member. So in CD13, where Mitch O'Farrell is, I was trying to, my purpose wasn't just to like be mean to him about his the terminology that he doesn't like. I was actually trying to talk to him about like, where did the like order to do this cleanup happen? Where did that come from? And like, where is Lhasa? Are they present here at all? Because I didn't see them that day. And he said, yeah, this is coming from city council. But then when I pressed about whether or not it was coming from Mitch O'Farrell's office specifically, he sort of said, no, like, this is actually something that was requested by the park rangers. And Mitch O'Farrell is doing a lot to like provide services for people, et cetera. It very much mirrored like the exact conversation that many people have had with Mitch O'Farrell's office directly, but just that internal inconsistency immediately reveals itself as soon as you start asking people, why is this happening?
I'll tell a quick story. This is two like stories I heard recently that I'm now wondering if is an indication of what city policy is. I've driven the Sela van picking people up from encampments and driving them to our access center a couple times in the last few weeks. 2 weeks ago, I drove a guy from Alabama who had come to LA and spent a little bit of time here and then was extradited back to Alabama on a weed charge. I forget if I talk about this on the show. Yeah. And spent a little time in jail in Alabama, then had to take a Greyhound bus all the way back, try and get his car back. That'll never happen.
Wow.
But he was able to at least get his stuff out of his car and is now living in Cypress Park. So I was like, that's crazy. Extradited back to Alabama on a weed charge. Alabama is crazy. They're like sending people, bounty hunters out to get like people like this poor guy. And then last week, I heard that a guy that I knew from Sela who was living on Echo Park Lake named Lance had also been extradited back to Colorado on, I believe, I'm not sure what the charge was that he was sent back for. Basically, what I'm starting to gather is that it's not these other states saying like, hey, you have one of our most wanted criminals in your custody. It's L.A. I believe it's LAPD, whether it's the sheriff's department somewhere in the city, saying, hey, we have someone here who has an open warrant in your state. Can we please send them back to you?
Yeah.
I believe the effort is pushing people out of our city rather than these other places wanting to take them and imprison them.
I think that's absolutely right.
Something to look at. Are there any journalists out there that want to look into this story and see if it is new policy? It's to hear that for the first time twice in the last couple weeks is a little weird to me. Let's celebrate some very good news. There's some really exciting new policy coming out of City Hall, in particular one council office. Mike Bonin, friend of the show, got in front of City Hall this week and put a set of motions forward for a plan that he calls Homes Guarantee LA. It is so great. It is so exciting. It's taking a lot of ideas that have been proposed at the federal level by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, Bernie Sanders, basically attempting to guarantee everyone the right to affordable, permanent, stable housing. What are some of the motions like put forward in this package?
I can say that. So the rent stabilization ordinance in LA is that the rent for 75% of the rental units in the city, anything that was used as an apartment building from 1978 or prior, the landlord is allowed to increase the rent in accordance with 100% of the CPI increase, which is like an inflation index. And that amount has to be between 3%, which is the floor, and 8%, which is the ceiling.
Yeah, it's tied to inflation unless inflation is below 3%, and then you can still raise the rent by 3% no matter what. This is a lot. A 3% increase really adds up year to year. First of all, it's price. You get a 3% raise 1 year, and then that new price, it's 3% on top of that. It has also not reflected inflation. It's been above inflation for, I think, 9 out of the last 10 years or something like that. We actually had deflation a couple years, but rents were still going up by 3%. It is some of the dumbest, most damaging policy that the city of LA has. There are numbers showing that for every 5% rent increase, 2,000 more people in LA become homeless.
Wow.
And we're basically guaranteeing that that will happen every year and a half or so in policy that is just like baked into the rent stabilization ordinance.
So the changes that Mike Bonin, council member from the 11th district on the west side, is proposing are really exciting, because what he is seeking to do is eliminate the floor. So that part of the rent stabilization ordinance that says even if there's no inflation or if there's deflation in a given year, a landlord would still be able to increase rent by 3%. That would be eliminated completely. He would also change it so that instead of being 100% of the consumer price index, which so like last year it was 4% of inflation in the LA region, so your rent went up 4% instead of 3%. So instead of being 100% of that change, it would be 60%. This would bring it more in line with some cities in the LA area that have stronger rent control than LA, Santa Monica and West Hollywood in particular.
So this was your personal experience. This was, you kind of went through this with your landlord.
Yeah. Well, so what happened to me, we started talking about this last year, like I said. So last year was the first time in 15 plus years that rents in LA went up 4% instead of 3%. We discussed that it was a year of higher than we were kind of like in an era of sustained low inflation, which is contrary to when the rent stabilization ordinance was passed in the 70s. It was an era of extremely high inflation. That was why they had the 8% ceiling put in place. But we talked about this as a way in which it kind of just seemed like a slap in the face from elected city officials to renters that they have not really changed the RSO in so long.
And in this kind of like housing crunch with homelessness spiking the way it has, to just kind of stand by and let this process happen where rent is going up by more than ever.
Mike Bonin brings up in this package that for somebody who's been in the same rent stabilized unit for the past decade, their rent probably has gone up about 50% and their income has probably gone up not at all.
Yeah.
So we kind of talked about this last summer just in terms of like, does city council know that they can do something about this? David Rue in Council District 4 launched into an extended period of moaning about like Sacramento not doing anything and like how Costa Hawkins tied the city council's hands, which I pointed out was not true. They can change the RSO anytime it's city ordinance.
They can't expand which units are rent controlled, but the 80% of units that are, they can get rid of, they could take it to zero if they wanted to.
Exactly. And so Mike Bonin is now proposing to do this. It's an amazing step. He's also asked the city attorney's office to look into the legality of implementing a rent freeze for some of the people who have been most hit by the previous years of rent increases. And then there's also another aspect, Alyssa, maybe you can talk about the like home guarantee part of this.
Yeah, the homes guarantee is this national movement. There are some candidates that have joined, you know, they take a pledge not to take developer money, which, as we were laughing, won't work so well in LA, probably.
Probably not be so popular with some of his fellow council members.
And it is this idea that, you know, housing is a human right. It's a lot of the policies that we've seen introduced at the federal level. These are things coming out of like the House Democrats, the Justice Democrats. We don't know if they're really going to move forward in this current political state, but it's great to get all this framework kind of up there and ready, teed up for the next president of the country.
But this is great because, I mean, it's exactly what we've been talking about on this show for at least the last several weeks. It provides a standard around which the activist base in LA can rally people who would like to see this kind of thing enacted. And that by doing so, by making this public announcement, very conspicuously, Mike Bonin was alone among sitting council
members.
Well,
he was with activists, which is also important, I think, too. It was a lot of the groups that were, you know, oppose unless amend to SB 50. And then people were like, well, what do you want? Well, this is what they want. these groups.
He was not literally alone. And I think he has a lot of popular support for these proposals, but
alone. They were seconded of the five motions that he put forward. All of them were seconded by Marquise Harris-Dawson, council member for District 8. I believe new council president Nuri Martinez got in on three of them, mm-hmm. which was nice to see. Mm-hmm. Some of them were co-signed by other council members. There was a decent amount of support for some of more than others. Should we just lay out what some of the other...
One more aspect I think that is really important is this idea that we're going to start building social housing, public housing again, and looking at not only what land we have available, but how to finance it in a way that you have a mixed income property. You don't just go out for funding like what we've done with like HHH, for example, where you have to get tons of places from money from different places and all get everybody together and work to get together to build it. This would be people who could afford to live there, could pay more rent, and it would help to offset if say somebody couldn't. I think he actually did say like pay what you can.
Sliding scale.
Mm-hmm. And this is also what we want. Like we want mixed income communities that are close to transit and have services and have shops. I mean, this was the goal maybe of SB 50 that these groups, the advocacy groups, weren't quite sure if we were going to be able to achieve that based on some of the stuff that was part of this bill. So this is super exciting. And someone gets to go to European countries as part of this bill and do some like research. So I want to go on that trip with Mike Bonin in the city. It's pretty exciting.
There are also, he mentioned disclosure requirements for LLCs, developers, rental agencies to determine basically who is buying up these properties. Mm-hmm. We will be talking about this later in the show related to Aaron Mendelson's story about PAMA management. The council member's office sent us the entire audio of his announcement. They know their audience. They knew we would be into this. I just want to say, all the other council members, you can pander to us. There's like, we will play your voice.
Be rewarded
on the show. So let's play a little clip of it right now.
This is about housing for all, and this is about ensuring the dignity of a safe, accessible, sustainable, permanently affordable home for everybody in Los Angeles. Throughout the city, people are being squeezed out of their home. Throughout the city, people are doubling, tripling, even quadrupling up in homes. People are moving out of Los Angeles entirely or moving far away and enduring grueling commutes to get to work. And more in Los Angeles, people who cannot afford housing are living on our streets.
It's nice to hear this kind of rhetoric, which you do hear a lot coming out of the city, but actually attached to meaningful legislation.
This is different than some other things that we've had in the past. I would say notably the LA Green New Deal, in that it doesn't just feel like a co-optation of progressive rhetoric. It feels like it is actually probably the most significant progressive reform package that we've seen in quite some time come out of LA City Council. I hope that manifests in some material change, but it's a very good set of policies. Yeah.
Let's talk about a story that came out on Friday. The New York Times reported that Customs and Border Patrol and the Trump administration is sending, they have these elite squad SWAT style units armed with smoke grenades and like heavy artillery and tanks and body armor and stuff that normally patrol the border.
Right.
They are now being sent into American cities, specifically what they call sanctuary cities, not what LA calls itself. We are a city of sanctuary.
Right.
But they're sending these units into places like New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and LA to provide reinforcements for ICE.
These are, I mean, if you maybe have already seen images of these on social media, I believe that like there were like pictures of tanks rolling through Queens, I feel like, in New York City that circulated like a month or so ago. And it seems like now that is being expanded to other cities, including Los Angeles.
Yeah. And so what they said, like they're not operating raids by themselves. I believe they've shown up in LA as of this weekend.
Yeah.
But they will just be like providing backup for ICE. But also the Times article said that they were hoping this would lead to a 35% increase in arrests. Alyssa, but there were some discrepancies in some of the reporting between what the LA Times was saying and what the first article said.
Just comparing the headlines, like the New York Times story literally had like a person in a tank and it was like, this is happening exactly what you described. But the LA Times story was just like, Border Patrol looking for more resources in cities or something like that. I mean, I don't know how you can sugarcoat it in that way or if that even accurately describes the situation of what's happening.
Yeah, no. And it's this is so like the urgency, I feel like, of the whole demilitarize the police movement that had like originated. It originated with Black, specifically Angelenos, in the 80s in response to the LAPD, which was the first police force in the nation to really start generating these SWAT force.
Resources.
Yeah, military grade personnel strategies. And I feel like now the urgency of that is can become more apparent. I mean, we know that the Border Patrol is widely regarded to be the most troubled and openly racist of the law enforcement entities in the American structure of government. There have been a number of stories within the past year about like Facebook groups that Border Patrol agents go on, the epithets that they use for the immigrants that they detain and attack and sometimes casually joke about victimizing. And even the thing is, like, this isn't even popular among like ICE agents, which should tell you a lot about like how toxic of a strategy it is. And it is intended to engender panic and anger. And it is just like really just a frightening turn of events.
Yeah.
So how are our politicians responding to it, Hayes?
So Mayor Garcetti went on KNX 1070 the day this story came out, and he was asked about it, and we can play his response.
I think it's called BORTAC, which is not a comedy movie, but an actual elite group of border agents who mostly work on the border in very dangerous situations. And I'm glad that they do that there. I think the idea of bringing them into cities or targeting quote unquote sanctuary cities as if they need to have people with tank-like vehicles bashing down doors here seems pretty ludicrous. We had no heads up, our Los Angeles Police Department. We actually work well to stay out of each other's lanes. As people know, we don't enforce immigration laws here, and LAPD won't enforce immigration laws here. It's not our responsibility. But the idea of doing this, when, by the way, they said they were going to have this massive crackdown and arrests are actually down when it comes to immigration arrests in Los Angeles. So this administration has not even produced what it said it would, thankfully, in this case. But we want these resources to go after truly dangerous people. And you've got to be careful. If you have people who are in tactical gear and things like that, without coordinating that with local law enforcement, that can be very dangerous. So we're waiting to hear more details, but it seems to maybe be more politics than policy.
So I think that technically qualifies as a criticism.
Yeah.
There's some important points in there. He talks about how heavily, even if the plan is for them to go after violent individuals, their casualty arrests, literal casualties from raids like these. But in general, it is a pretty weak response. There's a lot of he talks about how he's glad they're doing the work on the border that they're doing. Mm-hmm. He says that he sort of mocks Trump for not arresting as many people in Los Angeles as he said that he would.
Yeah.
There's a lot to, they're just talking about like it's policy rather, politics rather than policy. Like yeah. When the president talks about sending armed paramilitary units to forcibly deport your residents and separate from their families, his response is basically like, okay, go off.
Yeah. I mean, it is I think a strain of particularly liberal or democratic criticism of the Trump administration that is like, well, he's not even a credible actor. He's lied 15,000 times since he took the oath of office. And it's like, well, that's not really, it's a denunciation, but it's not along the lines of, well, in the case of Trump, politics and policy are, they're not separable. And to treat them as though they were separable is to fundamentally misapprehend the danger of this president, especially in our cities.
And yet at the same time, the same day, right? Or mm-hmm. Same span of days, we have Ben Carson coming to town to participate in this USC yeah. homelessness, I don't know, what is it? Consortium Comment. Type thing. Yeah. Headed by Arnold Schwarzenegger's new like public policy school or something at USC, right? So, but you've got complete cooperation. And you've got, we can't wait to take these federal resources and do something great with it to possibly do a lower level version of criminalizing and people who are living on the streets here. So
absolutely. It's almost like Garcetti can't be too critical of the BORTAC teams that are being sent into LA, because like when he's saying, you know, what do we need? Tanks rolling through and busting down
tank-like vehicles.
The LAPD has been doing this for decades. Yeah. We laid the groundwork for now a
stealing our model
for now an authoritarian paramilitary to be imposed on us from without. We've been doing it from within for decades. And he doesn't have a problem with that. So he can't really criticize along those lines. But then the thing that to me is particularly striking is just like to go back to the families belong together march of maybe a year and a half ago. Mayor Garcetti spoke at that, and there was a very popular abolish ICE movement at that point in time, probably our listeners will remember. And Garcetti said essentially the same thing then that he said now. So he's saying in this audio, we want these resources used to apprehend very dangerous people. And at that point in time, you know, in 2018, he said, it's time for ICE to do its job.
Do their job, yes.
This is basically the same thing. He is not objecting to, he's objecting more to the direction from the top of these agencies than actually the means and the terrorization that is, I would say, part and parcel to the strategy from the top to the bottom.
And he says in this interview and later that day, he and Police Chief Michael Moore did a video underscoring this, saying that LAPD does not cooperate with ICE. They do not get involved in ICE efforts. There is so much more the city can do to, instead of just like passively like not doing anything, can actually actively protect people. We have something in LA called the Justice Fund that was first put forward in 2017 to provide defense, to provide attorneys for people going through the deportation process. And that has not been refunded. The city council has just put it on the back burner. And even like the initial funding allocation was not even close to enough to protect all the people in Los Angeles that are the victims of this process. There are active measures that cities can take that many other cities around the country are doing that LA has refused to. So instead of just standing around, there's a lot more like pushing we could do, pushing back on this kind of thing. I want to get to our guest, but let's do a brief segment called Don't Do That. We have a couple stories to talk about this week. One was Kevin De Leon, who is running for city council in District 14 downtown and Boyle Heights up to Eagle Rock area. It was revealed that he was participating in a meet and greet with Michael Noguera, who is the president of the Eagle Rock Chamber of Commerce and also is the father of Daniel Noguera, who is suspected of, with his friend, firebombing an encampment for people who are homeless in Eagle Rock last year. We talked about it pretty extensively at the time. Local activists found out about this and said, hey, do not do that.
Yeah.
And the De Leon campaign came out and said, okay, we are not doing this event. We are doing a different event with the same hosts at a different undisclosed location to protect the safety of the family.
The Noguera family.
Because they were thinking that protesters would home invade them or something like that, or firebomb the places where they live, potentially. Don't do that.
Don't do that. Yeah. Stop, please.
Joe Buscaino, council member for District 15, the shoelace running down to San Pedro, put forward a motion suggesting that all park rangers working for the city of Los Angeles should now carry guns. Don't do that.
This is absurd. I do think that there is, I just want to read his exact words for why this is something that is necessary. First, Buscaino, he starts by saying that we're going to double the size of the sworn park ranger force in the city of Los Angeles this year. So that's notable. Alyssa and I were wondering maybe if that was something to do with Measure A or money that came from previous parks taxes that we put in place. But his one sentence on why they actually need guns is, park rangers should have the full ability to utilize all law enforcement tools and equipment to ensure the safety and security of the public under all circumstances. That's it. Just
don't do that.
Don't do that. I mean, the
tools available for law enforcement are pretty broad.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
All of the park rangers should have all of these. I mean, it includes tank like vehicles and like,
well, if you've got like a sick mountain lion, Hayes, and you need to put him down.
Yeah, the park ranger.
The trash like grabber is not going to work.
Grenade launcher. Well, let's get to our guest. Aaron Mendelson from KPCC and LAist is going to talk about his huge story from this week about a slumlord who committed a huge number of code violations resulting in a lot of safety hazards and deaths. Let's talk to him right now on LA Podcast. Let's welcome our guest, Aaron Mendelson. What do you say, KPCC LAist or LAist KPCC?
I say both. Either way. Okay. Either way. Yeah. We're really both at this point.
Okay. First, would you like to correct me on my pronunciation of the subjects of your article that I have been mispronouncing since it came out?
So it's PAMA management.
PAMA management.
PAMA management.
What were you saying?
PAMA.
PAMA.
PAMA. I said PAMA when I first saw it too, but it turns out it's PAMA. And the name of the majority shareholder of PAMA is Mike Niger.
Okay. And what does, do we know what PAMA stands for?
That's actually a really interesting question. So they've given different answers at different times.
Okay.
They used to have a website that said it was an acronym for Prosperity, Aspire, Motivation, Achievement. Okay. If I'm not mistaken.
That sounds nice.
But it sounds very nice. At other times, Mike Niger has said that it's his brother's nickname. So.
Okay. It is in all caps.
It's usually styled in all caps, but not always.
It's a backronym. Wu-Tang did this all the time. And so I'm familiar.
Okay. Let's talk about this story. And I know this was a long process for you to discover the things that you did about this company, but we can talk about PAMA first. They are a huge landlord. And city of Los Angeles, the outer parts of the county, like how big is this company?
Yeah, all over Southern California and California, really. We estimate that they own 16,000 units at least. They probably operate more than that because they also manage for some outside owners is a small part of their business. So 16,000 units, well over 4,000 parcels of land.
Wow.
This is in San Bernardino County, Riverside County, Los Angeles County, up in Kern, and then also to the Sacramento and Fresno areas. So they have a footprint across the state of California. This is more than $1 billion worth of real estate, and they were kind of hiding in plain sight.
And what attracted you to this story? How did they first come to your notice?
So I had been looking at eviction records in San Bernardino County of the eviction lockouts, like the very last step of the process. And I kept seeing very similar company names popping up mm-hmm. again and again. So I would see like the plaintiff would be Cobra 28 number 3. And then a few lines later, like Cobra 28, number 7.
Yeah.
So I became curious what these very similarly named entities were. It turned out many of them traced back to PAMA management and the Niger family. And it was a long road from there, but that was the first step.
Now, these are all different company, all different LLCs under the same umbrella. What's involved in the process of tracing an LLC back to, I mean, it's not easy to do, to connect them to the parent company, right?
Yeah, so it's LLCs and limited partnerships and corporations, all these different things. It's, if you know the name, it's relatively simple. You can go to the Secretary of State's website, look it up. It'll have some limited amount of information. We started seeing so many of them that we got data on all the different business entities in California and searched through that to see members of the Niger family and their business associates, and also their mailing address in El Monte, which is where their headquarters is. I think if you really wanted to hide your ownership a little more, you could take further steps that they had not taken. But it is difficult, like you guys were saying earlier in the show, to trace back who controls property. This is an issue that Mike Bonin was talking about this week, and also revealed the investigative news organization recently sued the federal government, trying to get information about the beneficial owners of property across the country.
So you're looking into these evictions, you find that they're all connected to this one company, and then you start visiting some of these properties, you start talking to the tenants, and you uncover a series of really shocking safety hazards, code violations, some that may have resulted in fatal deaths for some tenants of these properties. So talk about some of the stuff that you found.
Yeah, so we started visiting the properties once the kind of picture became clear of just how many properties they owned. We visited more than a half dozen, everywhere from San Bernardino to City of LA to up to the Bakersfield area. And, you know, we would go in, we'd try not to ask leading questions, just ask the tenants what the conditions are like, and heard some pretty shocking stories. So the very first one I went to was in the city of Pomona. It was a mobile home mm-hmm. park that we knew very little about when we showed up and started talking to tenants there. It turned out that there had been a typhus outbreak in the park.
Wow.
Something that hadn't happened in Los Angeles County for 6 years before that.
Yeah.
And first heard about that through through the tenants, and that was later backed up by public records and even academic research that was done, because a typhus outbreak is pretty rare. So the Centers for Disease Control came to this park, and public health officials came and started trapping cats and opossums. One detail in the story is that they found an opossum with 1,087 fleas on it.
Whoa.
Which was alarming to me. They wrote about this in a
very precise number.
It's incredibly precise. And we tried to figure out exactly how you count fleas. Yeah. And I wasn't able to. But yeah, the public health researchers wrote about this in a journal called Neglected Tropical Diseases.
Oh, my God.
And that was just at one park. We later learned just at this park that they had had their license suspended multiple times over sewage issues. Part of the story is about the way that rental housing is regulated, and cities don't regulate mobile home parks. And it was very frustrating to the city of Pomona that there had been these long-running sewage issues at this park, but they felt their hands were tied.
What does that mean, that cities don't regulate mobile home parks?
What agency is responsible for that?
So for mobile home parks, it's a state agency, HCD, regulates them. So you can have a situation where you might have two properties right next door mm-hmm. that are owned by the same people, but they're regulated by different agencies that are probably aren't talking to one another.
And does the state department that is responsible for regulating these, I know that we've seen in local housing departments in Southern California writ large, but also in Los Angeles County specifically, there's frequently the complaint that the enforcement is not really there. Is that magnified for these properties that should be enforced by the state agency? Or do they have similar issues with enforcement?
I don't know if I have the answer for you for that, but something that I heard a lot from tenant advocates and lawyers was about this sort of lack of follow through, mm-hmm. especially outside the city of LA and a lot of these smaller cities. They're very cash squeezed and the departments just don't have the juice to like go out and proactively look at rental housing.
Right.
You also went out to, I believe it was also a mobile home park in Oildale, outside Bakersfield in Kern County. Talk about what you heard there.
Yeah, so this is, if you're not familiar with Oildale, it's just north of the Kern River in the Bakersfield area. It's famous for being the birthplace of Merle Haggard. He grew up in a boxcar there, famously, that you can now go visit. Kern County is a place that PAMA management has expanded into in recent years. They focus on kind of low-income housing, a lot of it in outlying areas of Southern California. So this was kind of a natural jump for them. They own a number of rental units and mobile home parks in Oildale, which is in unincorporated Kern County, including one called the 4J's Trailer Park. And in 2016, there was a fire at a trailer in the trailer park there, and a five-month-old girl died.
Wow.
Her name was Jenica Lozano. Following this fire, there was a very thorough state investigation, and they uncovered all sorts of issues with the way that the property was rented and sold. It was this rent-to-own contract that they determined broke real estate law. Gosh, there was a lot more. All sorts of authorities got involved. State housing authorities, the Department of Real Estate tried to revoke the licenses of Mike Niger and a number of his business partners. They revoked the license of one of his businesses and one of his longtime business partners, but not his license. There was also a criminal case that came out of this. The arson investigator had recommended criminal charges, and the Kern County District Attorney did charge PAMA management with involuntary manslaughter. A judge had decided, there was a hearing, and a judge decided that the evidence wasn't there to go forward with the charges. And one of the issues that came up in the criminal case was that it was difficult to determine the ownership of these different business entities that PAMA had been using. And so I spoke to a attorney for the Department of Real Estate who did the license case where they took away the two licenses. And he said that this was basically the absolute worst case scenario in rental housing, where you have negligence that leads to the death of a blameless child, really, because there were all sorts of issues with this trailer, with the wiring in the park. There were holes in the roof of the trailer that may have allowed air to rush in and make the fire worse. It's really the worst case scenario, and it's a really tragic circumstance.
The stories you're talking about are really just scratching the surface of this company's properties. Mold, bed bugs, roaches, discrimination against families with children. There's an executive quoted as saying that they'll charge $50 to any tenants who have children that play outside, and they won't accept any excuses like it's summertime or the children are not in school. They can go somewhere else to play. We're talking about decades too, right? Of violations and abuse. This company is still not just active, is as big as it's ever been. How have they been getting away with this for so long? You give the example of that one case where they were sort of unable to pinpoint liability or the ownership. Is that consistent across all of these cases?
I don't know that. If I could reframe your question a little bit. I mean, one thing that I heard a lot in this reporting was that low-income tenants don't have a lot of political power. So our kind of code enforcement system is often based in most places on you have to make a report and then it will be investigated. Mm-hmm. If you're in a situation where you don't want to lose your housing yep. or you're not documented, you're probably not going to make that report. The issue also, you know, is impacts city and state government, right? We know that landlord groups, real estate groups are very powerful and put a lot of money towards, you know, representing their interests in the state house, in city hall. There are people who advocate, of course, for low-income tenants, but the dollar amount is nowhere near the same thing. So you were talking about sort of the long-running nature of these problems. You can really see that at a very large complex here in Los Angeles, the Chesapeake Apartments on what's now Obama Boulevard. Mike Niger connected entities, I should say, have controlled this property since the mid-90s, since December 1996. And the city attorney filed suit over the property a couple years ago and said that there had been basically decades of neglect, that the property was extremely unsafe for anyone who set foot on the property, they said, and that this was it didn't have to be like this. The better property management would lead to a much better place to live for the people who are there.
And this is an empire, it turns out, that goes beyond just owning these properties. They own the management company that operates them. They own the supply warehouse where they get the supplies to maintain these properties.
Yeah, hardware store.
Yeah, hardware store. The Mike Niger's son owns part of the Las Vegas Golden Knights. I'm not sure how that ties into the supply chain necessarily, but this is like a pretty sprawling operation. What's been the aftermath of this investigation? Has there been any move towards regulating entities like these better?
So to the first part of what you're saying, it's really like vertically integrated yeah. to an unusual degree. So you have the property ownership basically in the same hands of the people who are doing the property management, what a property management expert called in a legal filing a captured relationship that led to astoundingly lax conditions at the Chesapeake Apartments in LA. Then you also have, because they own this hardware store in El Monte, they're buying hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of hardware at their own store. So there's nothing illegal about that. And in fact, from a business point of view, it might be a great idea. But it's certainly unusual in the property management and landlording world. To the second part of your question, you know, what has happened since we published this story? It's still brand new. It, mm-hmm. it came out on Tuesday night, and really Wednesday, I think, is when people started to see it. But we've seen response from some politicians. So it became an issue in the 4th District Council race. Palma Management and Patricia Niger, who's married to Mike Niger, had donated to David Rue. Mm-hmm. And that came under fire from two candidates running against Rue. And he has since said that he's returning those donations, or rather said that he's already returned those donations. We also heard the story mentions a bill that failed in Sacramento last year that would have tracked information about rental housing across California in larger complexes. What seems to me like pretty basic stuff, you know, like rents, how many units there are, what's the ownership, how many evictions did they have. This bill failed last time around, but after our story published, the assembly member Buffy Wicks from Oakland said she was going to reintroduce it this time around. It got the backing in a tweet from David Chu, the assembly member from Oakland. So we saw some movement there. And we asked Javier Becerra about this. He said, I'm paraphrasing, but he, speaking generally, said, you know, we have seen some landlords getting away with literally murder. He said also that it was mostly the responsibility of local jurisdictions to track and prosecute and file cases over these things. And we may see other responses from people running for office.
I saw something great from Michael Lenz, friend of the show, UCLA professor. And his suggestion was for the city of LA to eminent domain every single one of these properties and make it part of our public housing program that we're going to start and make sure that these are safer and probably not just the code violations, but also you're talking about probably like earthquake safety, all these things that are probably not being done. And could we take that land? Could we seize this land and bring it back under our jurisdiction?
And you wonder at what point it's not just like an eminent domain process, but a criminal asset seizure procedure.
Right.
Do in a lot of cases that don't involve big landlords. I'm interested in that response by Javier Becerra. He's the attorney general for the state of California, talking about how this should be on local municipalities. But for such a huge, I mean, how many cities are we talking about that PAMA has a presence in? It might be in the hundreds, right?
It's certainly in the dozens.
Okay.
And that's part of the issue. You know, regulators aren't really connecting the dots.
Yeah.
So they may look at one property and say there's issues here, fix those. You know, we saw in San Bernardino, they put a lien on an apartment property. There's the case here in Los Angeles, the case in Oildale, but no one's really stepping back to look at the big picture.
Right.
And this is a system that probably worked better when landlording was more of a mom and pop thing. But in 2020, when we've got corporate landlords and there's many other ones aside from PAMA management, it doesn't really step back to assess the totality of these agencies.
I'm curious about, I wonder if you could tell us a bit about what the intention is in a general sense when a landlord sets up an LLC like this. I think our listeners probably have a good conception of the term, you know, limited liability. But as you're talking about this, one thing that I'm noticing is that a lot of the enforcement that you're mentioning comes down to, is PAMA going to lose their license in this specific location or not, and not broader consequences for them as a company? How does limited liability corporation work in this context, and why do they seek it out?
Mm-hmm. So we found that PAMA had PAMA and connected businesses had at least 170 different entities, many of which were these limited liability corporations. These are really common in real estate, and it's quite common to have this like whole constellation of businesses. And one of the things it does is it separates the owners from liability in case there's issues on a property. And if you do want to be under the radar and not have your name attached to the building that you are getting profits from, an LLC is a good way to do that.
It separates the owner, from anything that might befall, like the company that owns a specific apartment building, for example. Is that right?
Right. So if you own the apartment building and something bad happens, if you're the owner, you know, your tenants might sue you. But if Scott LLC is the owner, then that becomes the subject of the lawsuit.
Right.
This story opens up so many threads, both like the violations of the law, but also some of the legal practices that they seem to be engaged in that seem to be very exploitative. There's a practice of in the trailer homes of renting to own that I think Matthew Desmond talks a lot about in his book Evicted in the Milwaukee area. But correct me if I'm wrong about how this works. They, like a company like PAMA Management, will sell you a trailer where they own the land underneath it still, right? But you own the actual mobile home, and they'll give you a loan at about a 10% rate. So they say you can buy this trailer for $10,000, I think was the case in your story, but we'll give you a loan on it that you pay back at an enormous interest rate, much, as you point out, more than double what you would expect for a home loan at that same time, and puts renters into a place where they can potentially never get out of this hole. And for like to purchase something that is like decrepit and not being maintained properly, because does that mean then that PAMA also has no obligation to maintain the trailer?
So what you were describing, the rent to own kind of leases, I guess, were a big issue after the fire in Oildale. The state real estate regulators really took issue with the rent to own contract there. The Rodriguez sisters, Marissa and Angelica, Marissa's boyfriend, Lorenzo, and their baby had signed this rent-to-own contract where required disclosures weren't provided. Angelica was the only adult at the time, and so she signed the contract. She didn't really understand what she was signing, and they didn't understand that they were doing this thing where they were buying this for 10 grand, as you say, at 10% interest. I couldn't tell you how, if this is happening at every single mobile home park connected to PAMA. It may be, it may not be.
And in this case, it was illegal, I guess, because they didn't have a permit to put a home in that space.
Right. And so the home never should have been rented out in the first place because there was no permit. You need to get a permit from HCD to rent out a mobile home.
But had there been a permit, it would have been a legal practice to lease it out this way.
Yes, given what they did, the required disclosures, like I say, didn't happen. Real estate law is very intricate, but it violated a number of provisions. But the permit is also really important when we're talking about this fire, you know, that turned out to be fatal. This was a dilapidated home. The disclosures that were supposed to happen did not happen. The mobile home wasn't even supposed to be there. And yet this company rented it out and a child died there.
No smoke detectors.
There were no smoke detectors, no carbon monoxide detectors.
None in adjacent homes either.
In at least one adjacent mobile home park, yeah.
Okay. And in terms of regulation on these, like, have you heard of any more attention being paid since some of these events from regulatory agencies, from the city, the state, or whatever, in terms of making sure, like, when you went, did they seem to be equipped with more safety equipment in the aftermath of this disaster?
Or? So I did visit the Oildale Mobile Home Park. I didn't go into any trailers, so it's hard to say there. I can tell you in Los Angeles at the Chesapeake apartment, I spoke to a resident who said that things had improved there after the city attorney filed a lawsuit and there was a settlement requiring a number of security improvements. They also gave tenants free loads of laundry, gift cards to the local grocery store. So one long-term tenant I spoke to said things have gotten better. I also spoke to another tenant there who said that, who was a Jamaican immigrant who had lived in Los Angeles, Atlanta, New York, and of course, Jamaica. And he said it was still the worst place he had ever lived.
Wow.
I don't want you to tip future stories, but as you're looking around, like, we've heard about these mega landlords in terms of single family homes, like Invitation Homes, the subsidiary of Blackstone, own a huge number of properties. Are you finding others that people haven't really caught on to at this point that are as like, do you feel like PAMA is an anomaly, or are there more of these out there?
I think the issue is that we don't know, right? Like, I can't tell you the answer to your question. Mm-hmm. So we do know about some of these larger Wall Street-backed mega landlords, but, you know, property ownership is just so opaque that it's really hard to say. It was such a heavy lift for us to figure out what we learned about PAMA that there may be PAMAs all over California.
And it would take sort of a state version of what Councilmember Mike Bonin is talking about locally, disclosure of ownership, that I assume would make your life easier.
Life a lot easier, yeah.
And there are some cities that have done that have required more than what we do here.
I do think that, like, when you discuss, Aaron, having a major operator, somebody that you mentioned was more or less hiding in plain sight, and also having committed such flagrant abuses of existing housing regulation in a variety of different venues, it does sort of raise the specter that even a somewhat smaller or somewhat less openly abusive management company or many such companies could easily exist under the present disclosure or lack thereof. And it would be borderline impossible, or you would have to be extremely lucky to find out. Because you're saying there were patterns of the tenant evictions, the patterns of codes being broken, and even without having that thread to go on, how would you even begin to discover another such operator in the state currently?
With a lot of hard work, but I think what you're saying points to a really important issue and something you guys have talked a lot, which is just the housing crisis in the state, mm-hmm. and the way that it's strengthened the hand of landlords and really weakened the hand of tenants. So it's kind of a musical chairs situation where we just don't have enough housing to go around.
Right.
And so if you are a low-income tenant, someone who may be, like many of the people I spoke to said some version of this, that it's either this or the street or this or my car, I don't have anywhere else to go. So if you are in that situation, you're not going to make complaints. You don't have anywhere else to go because it's so hard to find affordable housing that you feel like you're stuck.
And I would say here in the cities, we have public council, we have a lot of resources, and you hear about a lot of rent strikes and end up becoming very successful when a lot of these apartment people who live in apartments kind of work together and get good advice, like legal advice. But then in a rural area, I mean, where would you even begin? Like, you wouldn't know who is even in charge of, you know, the place that you're living, and you wouldn't have those resources available to you. So, I mean, that seems to be part of, we talk about all these you know, tenant protection bills that did and did not pass at the state level. And all of this needs to be accessible to everyone. It can't just be something when you live in a big city.
Yeah, to say nothing of if you are an English language learner or potentially undocumented, that makes navigating these systems hundreds of times more difficult.
Yeah, and I'll tell you when we'll find out, like, the problem is the next earthquake. I keep bringing this up.
Right.
But, like, these are the people where, you know, talk about deaths. These will be the collapse buildings and the, you know, where they never made the improvements. And it's always going to affect the lowest income Californians.
I want to say this show has a pretty good track record in terms of KPCC reporters coming on and wanting more disclosure laws. Your former colleague Annie Gilbertson came on the show wishing that the state would enforce police discipline cases to be disclosed. And I believe that did happen shortly after she went on the show.
Here's hoping.
Yes.
And I really did love how I think there was a thread posted after your story went up that had all your data, all the, you know, every single bit of information about how you reached your conclusions and maps. And I think that kind of stuff too can trigger other journalists, you know, can look through what you're doing and say, oh, there's an idea here for something I can follow up. So very much appreciated as far as the transparency and sharing it with other people. It's great.
The story has all 170 PAMA entities listed out. It is a fantastic piece of research and writing and storytelling that I think has already captured a lot of people's attention, but it should capture more people's attention. It should just keep growing because it's very, very significant. Aaron Mendelson, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Thanks, Aaron.
And thank you for listening to LA Podcast. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.